Track 12.
Fresh dhows from the mainland, heavily laden with cargo, came in to moor above the beach. Still, the six men on the terrace talked and debated, and the tide reached high slack, then began its ebb. All this time Al-Malik listened, and spoke little, while he allowed each of the others to say what was in their hearts, without check or restraint. Carefully he sifted the gems of wisdom from the dross. They reviewed the order of battle of those forces on which they could rely, and made lists of those sheikhs who were uncommitted or doubtful. They compared these to the powers that Ibn Yaqub commanded. Only when he had heard all they had to say did Al-Malik make his decision. It will depend upon the tribes of the deep desert, the Saar, the Dam, and the Karab. They are the greatest warriors of all the Omani. Without them, our cause cannot prosper. Yet we have not heard from them. We do not know in which direction they will point the war lance. His counsellors murmured agreement, and Al-Malik said softly, I must go to them. They were silent for a while, considering this bold course of action, and then Al-Alama said, Your brother the Caliph will not allow it. If you insist, he will smell danger on the wind. I will make the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, taking the ancient desert route to the holy places, the road that passes through the territory of the tribes. The Caliph cannot forbid a pilgrim under penalty of eternal damnation. There is great risk, Al-Alama said. There is never great gain without great risk, Al-Malik replied. And God is great. Allah Akbar, they replied. Surely God is great. Al-Malik made a graceful gesture of dismissal, and one by one they came to embrace him, kiss his hand, and take their leave. Al-Alama was the last, and Al-Malik said, Stay with me. It is the hour of Maghrib, the prayers at the setting of the sun. We will pray together. Two slave girls brought pitchers of pure sweet well water. The two men performed the ritual purification, washing their hands in the water that the girls poured for them from the silver pitchers, rinsing their mouths three times, snuffing water cupped in the right palm three times, and blowing it out of the nostrils with the fingers of the left hand, then going on to bathe their faces, arms, and feet. The slave girls left, and Al-Alama stood and faced the Kaaba in Mecca, thousands of miles to the north. Cupping his hands behind his ears, he began the call to prayer in a loud voice. Our God is great. I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. Come to prayer. Come to your own good. Below them in the courtyard and under the palm trees along the head of the beach, hundreds of robed figures assembled quietly and took up the posture of reverence, all facing in the same direction. The prayer has begun, chanted Al-Alama. When it was ended, Al-Malik gestured for the mullah to take a seat on the cushion close to his right hand. I saw the boy, Al-Amhara, on the beach when I arrived. Tell me, how has he fared in my absence? He grows like a tamarind tree, strong and tall. Already he is a fine horseman. He has a quick mind and a ready tongue, sometimes too ready. He is often prone to lack respect for his elders and betters. He does not take readily to criticism or restraint, and when he is angry or thwarted, his choice of invective would make a sea captain pale, Al-Alama said primly. Al-Malik hid his smile behind the rim of his coffee cup. What he heard only made him like his infidel son the more. He would make a leader of men. Al-Alama went on. He has come to manhood and been properly circumcised by Ben Abram. When the time comes for him to accept Islam, he will be ready. That is good, the prince said. And tell me, Holy Father, have your teachings borne fruit in that direction? He now speaks our language as though born to it, and he can recite long sections of the Holy Quran from memory. Al-Alama looked uneasy and evasive. Has he made any progress towards submitting himself to God? Al-Malik insisted. Without that, the prophecy can have no effect. The Prophet himself has said that no man can be forced to convert to Islam. He must come to it in his own way and in his own time. So your answer is no. He glories in argument, Sometimes I think the only reason he memorizes the Quran is the better to argue with me. He glories in the religion of his own people and boasts that one day he will be inducted into some Christian religious order, which he calls the Knights of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail, like his grandfather and his father before him. It is not for us to question the ways of Allah, Al-Malik said. God is great, Al-Alama endorsed his assertion. But there is more to tell concerning the boy. We have had an inquiry from the English consul in Zanzibar concerning him. Al-Malik leaned forward earnestly. I thought that the consul in Zanzibar had been murdered over a year ago. That was the man named Grey. Since his death, the English have sent another to take his place. I see. What form did this inquiry from the new man take? He describes the boy accurately, his age and colouring. He knows that Al-Amhara was captured by Al-Awuf, and that he was sold into slavery. He knows that he was bought by Your Excellency. He knows the name that we have given him, Al-Amhara. How has he learned all this? Worry lines creased Al-Malik's brow. I do not know, except that Ben Abraham has told me much about the boy's lineage. He met and spoke to Al-Amhara's elder brother when the Franks captured him at Al-Awuf's base. The prince nodded. What does the doctor know concerning the boy? His family is noble, close to the English king. Despite his youth, Al-Amhara's brother is a formidable fighting mariner, and he has sworn a mighty oath to find and rescue his younger brother. Perhaps it is this family who is behind these inquiries from Zanzibar. We do not know this for certain, but it would be wise not to ignore these questions. Al-Malik pondered this, then asked, "The English are buyers and owners of slaves. How can they object to the same practice in others? What can they do to force us to their will? Their land is far away, at the end of the earth. They cannot send an army against us." Ben Abraham says that the Franks have perfidious ways of making war. They issue firman to the captains of their armed merchant ships against their enemies. These men are like sharks or barracudas. They come for plunder. Would the English king declare war on us over one child? Ben Abraham fears that he might, not only for the sake of the child, but also for the excuse to send their ships into our waters, to seize the territory and the riches of the Omani. I will think on all you have told me. Al-Malik dismissed him. Bring Ben Abraham and the boy to me here tomorrow after the Zuhr prayers. Dorian came to his audience with the prince, consumed by both trepidation and excitement at the prospect. When he had first met the prince, Dorian had been possessed of no such qualms. Al-Malik had been only another Mussulman, an enemy and a pagan chief. However, he had learned much since he had been under the instruction of Al-Alama and Ben Abram. He now knew that the prince's claim to royalty stretched back as far as that of the English king. He knew of his exploits as a sailor and a warrior, of the reverence his subjects felt towards him. In addition to this, the spiritual umbilical cord that bound Dorian to England and Christianity was unravelling and eroding with time and great distance. These days he never had an opportunity to speak his own language. He thought in Arabic, and had difficulty recalling the English words for even the simplest ideas. Even his memories of his family were fading. He thought of his brother Tom only on occasion, and all ideas of escape from Lamu had been abandoned. He no longer thought of his state here on the island as one of captivity. Slowly he was being absorbed into the Arab world and the Arab way of thought. Now confronted with the prince again, he was overcome with awe and reverence. When he knelt before Al-Malik on the coral stones of the terrace and asked for his blessing, his heart ran faster with surprise and pleasure at the form in which the prince returned his greeting. "Come and sit beside me, my son. We have much to discuss." This regal and impressive man had reaffirmed him as his son in front of these witnesses. Dorian felt proud, then experienced a sharp pang of guilt. He had a fleeting image of his true father, but the picture in his mind of Hal's face was blurring. "I will always be true to my real father," he promised himself staunchly. But he obeyed Al-Malik's invitation promptly and gladly. In my absence you have become a man. Al-Malik studied him keenly. Yes, my lord, Dorian replied, and had to stop himself, adding automatically, by the grace of Allah. I can see that this is so. Al-Malik picked out the outline of firm young muscle and breadth of shoulders beneath the kanzu that Dorian wore so naturally. And it is therefore fitting that you should relinquish the name of the child and take in its stead the name of the man. From henceforth you shall be called Al-Salil. It is the will of Allah, Al-Alama and Ben Abram said together. They both looked proud and pleased with this honour that the prince had accorded their protégé. It redounded to their credit, for the name the prince had chosen was a propitious one. It meant the drawn sword. Your beneficence is like the rising of the sun after the dark night, Dorian replied, and Al-Alama nodded his approval at the choice of words and their inflection. It is also fitting that you should have your own lance-bearer. Al-Malik clapped his hands, and a young man stepped out onto the terrace with a long, raking stride, like that of a racing camel. He was probably 15 years older than Dorian, in his late 20s, and a warrior by his dress and mien. He wore a curved scimitar at his waist and carried a round bronze shield on his shoulder. This is Batula, the prince told him. He will make his oath to you. Batula came to Dorian and knelt in front of him. From this day forward you are my liege lord, he said in a strong, clear voice. Your enemies are my enemies. Wherever you may ride, I shall carry your lance and your shield at your right hand. Dorian put his hand upon Batula's shoulder in acceptance of the pledge, and Batula rose to his feet. The two young men looked each other in the face, and instinctively Dorian liked what he saw there. Batula was not handsome of features, but his face was broad and honest, his nose large and hawkish. When he smiled, his teeth were even and white. He wore his thick, dark hair oiled with ghee and twisted into a braid over one wide shoulder. Batula is an exponent of the lance, Al-Malik said, and a warrior tried in battle. There is much he has to teach you, Al-Salil. The lance was the weapon of the true Arab horseman. Dorian had watched the novices at practice on the field of arms, and had thrilled to the charge of pounding hoofs, the steely flash of the lance points as they picked a suspended brass finger ring out of the air at full charge. I shall be a willing pupil, Dorian promised. Al-Malik dismissed Batula. When he had left the terrace, the prince resumed. Very soon I shall undertake another long journey to the north, the pilgrimage to Mecca, through the sands and the wilderness of the deserts. You will accompany me, my son. My heart rejoices that you choose me, great lord. Al-Malik made the gesture of dismissal, and when Dorian had gone, he turned back to Al-Alama and Ben Abraham. You will send a message to the Sultan in Zanzibar for him to pass on to the English consul there. He paused to collect the words, then went on. Tell him that Prince Al-Malik indeed purchased Al-Amkhara from Al-Auf. He did this to take the boy under his protection and to shield him from harm. Tell him that despite all Al-Malik could do to protect him, Al-Amkhara fell sick of a pestilence and that he died a year ago. He is buried here on the island of Lamu. Tell him that Al-Malik has spoken thus. Al-Alama bowed. It shall be as you command, Your Excellency. He was impressed by this ingenious solution. Al-Amkhara is dead, Al-Malik went on. You will erect a headstone in the cemetery with that name on it. Al-Amkhara is dead. Al-Salil lives on. By God's grace, Al-Alama acknowledged the order. I shall take the boy with me into the desert and leave him with the Tsar to hide him. There in the sands he will learn the warrior's way. In time the Franks will forget that he once existed. This is a wise decision. Al-Salil is more than a son to me. He is my living talisman. I shall never yield him to the demands of the Franks, he said softly but firmly. The Swallow came up the channel, then tacked into the roads of Zanzibar. Ahead there were 10 sail of square-rigged ships lying in the anchorage, besides a mass of Arab dhows. Tom Courtney looked them over carefully. They flew the flags of some of the great trading nations of the Northern Hemisphere, with a preponderance of Portuguese and Spaniards. "Not a Frenchie in sight, Mr. Tyler," Tom announced with relief. He did not relish the complications of sharing a neutral port with ships of the enemy. "No," agreed Ned, "but there is at least one East Indiaman." He pointed out the tall ship, a princess of the ocean, displaying the majesty of the company. "They will offer us an even frostier welcome than the Frenchies would have done." Tom grinned recklessly. "I give not a fig for them," he said. "They can do nothing to us outside the courts of England, and we will not be back there for a while," he added under his breath, "not until they drag me there in chains." He glanced up at his own masthead, devoid of any flag. He had not wanted to announce his nationality. "As soon as we anchor, I will go ashore and pay a visit to the new consul," he told Ned. He had spoken to the captain of another English ship in Table Bay when they broke their long voyage at Good Hope. The captain had told him that Grey had a successor in the consular office in Zanzibar. "He's some young fellow sent from Bombay after Grey was murdered to take over the consular duties for the Fever Coast and, of course, more importantly, to see to the interest of John Company in those areas." "What's his name?" Tom had wanted to know. "I don't recall. I've never met him. But by all accounts, he is surly and difficult, enchanted by his own importance." Tom watched as Ned took the Swallow into the bay, and they dropped the anchor in water so clear they could see the multicoloured fish swarming over the coral heads 4 fathoms under the keel. "I will take Aberley ashore with me," Tom said as soon as the longboat was launched. The two landed on the stone jetty beneath the walls of the old Portuguese fort and made their way into the narrow streets. The heat and the stinking bustle were all so familiar that Tom could hardly credit that it was almost 2 years since last he had come ashore here. They asked for directions from the Arab harbour master. "No, no," he told them. "The new consulate is no longer an effendi, Grey's old house in the town. I will send a boy to show you the way." And he picked out one of the ragged urchins from the swarm who were pestering the Ferengi for alms. "This son of Shaitan will guide you. Do not give him bakshish of more than one anna." The boy danced ahead, leading them out of the jumble of narrow alleys and ramshackle buildings into the palm groves. Along a sandy road, a mile or more beyond the last hovel, they came to a large villa behind high walls. Although the house seemed old, the outer wall had been repaired recently and painted with burnt limewash. The roof of the main house that showed above the top of the wall was freshly thatched with palm fronds. There were 2 brass plaques on the gate. One was engraved, "His Majesty's Consulate." Below that was the company's emblem of rampant lions and the legend, "Office of the United Company of Merchants of England Trading to the East Indies." A servant answered Tom's ring at the outer gates in the wall, and Tom sent him with a note to his master. After a few minutes, the man returned. Tom left Aberley to wait for him in the courtyard and followed him. The main house was laid out around gardens and fountains in the Oriental style of architecture. The ceilings were high, but the rooms sparsely furnished. There were, however, vases of tropical flowers in the rooms through which the servant led Tom, and these floral decorations and the arrangement of cushions on the austere hardwood furniture suggested a feminine hand. At last the servant led Tom into a large room with stone floors and bookcases lining the walls. "Please to wait here, effendi. The master will come soon." Left to himself, Tom looked up at the slowly revolving fan and the arrangement of lines and pulleys that led through a hole in the wall to where a slave pulled rhythmically on a line to keep the fan turning. Tom walked to the writing desk in the centre of the floor and glanced at the quill stand and inkpot set out precisely, and at the piles of documents bound with red ribbon and stacked with military precision. Then he turned from the desk and wandered along the bookshelves, trying to divine from their contents the character of the man he had come to meet. The shelves were filled with heavy ledgers and bound reports with the company emblem embossed on the spine. There was nothing of a personal nature on display, and the room had a soulless feel to it. He was alerted by a footstep on the flags on the terrace outside the entrance to the inner courtyard, and he turned just as a tall, lean figure appeared in the doorway. The bright tropical sun was behind him, so Tom did not recognize him at once. The consul stopped and let his eyes adjust to the gloom of the room after the brilliant sunshine outside. He was dressed in a sober black serge costume with a white lace collar. Then he stepped into the room and removed the wide-brimmed black hat from his head. Tom saw his face clearly for the first time. For a long moment his astonishment was so intense that he could neither move nor speak. Then he laughed and started forward. "Guy! Is it really you?" Impulsively he opened his arms to embrace his twin brother. It was obvious that Guy Courtney's surprise was as great as Tom's. A host of differing emotions showed briefly on his face, then were gone. His features became cold and stiff, and he stepped back from Tom's embrace. "Thomas," he said, "I had no idea that it was you. You signed a false name on your note." "Neither had I any idea that it was you," Tom said, and let his welcoming arms fall to his sides. He avoided the accusation of using a false name. He had deemed it wise not to use his real name here, in case by some strange chance a warrant for the murder of William had reached Zanzibar ahead of him. He watched Guy's expression for some sign that this had happened, and judged that he could not rely on his twin to shelter him from justice. They stared at each other in silence for a minute, which seemed to Tom like all eternity. Then Guy held out his right hand. With relief, Tom took it. Guy's grip was limp and his flesh as cool as his expression. He dropped Tom's hand after only a brief contact, then turned away to his desk. "Please be seated, Thomas." He indicated the high-backed chair across the room without looking directly at his brother. "I trust that you have not returned to these waters to indulge in any form of trade. The fact that you use an assumed name makes me think that that may be the case." When Tom did not reply at once, he went on. "I must warn you that my first loyalty is to the company." He made it sound as though he was invoking the name of God. "And I will immediately send a report to London." Tom stared at him, feeling his anger boil up swiftly. "Merciful heavens, Guy, is that your first concern? Are we not brothers? Do you not want to know about Father and Dorian?" "I am already aware of Father's death. The company's ship that lies in the harbour this day brought me a letter from Lord Childs and from our brother William in England," Guy replied. Tom felt a surge of relief at this confirmation that he had not yet heard of William's death. Guy replaced the quill in its holder and went on. "I have mourned Father's passing in my own way, so there is nothing more to say on that score." His mouth hardened. "Besides, you were always his favourite. I meant little to him." "That is not true, Guy. Father loved us all equally," Tom burst out. "So you say," Guy shrugged. "As for Dorian, I heard that he was lost at sea, drowned and dead." "No, he was not." Tom made no effort to keep his voice down. "He was captured by the Muslimmen and sold into slavery." Guy laughed without humour. "You are always one for a wild tale. I assure you, as His Majesty's consul in these territories, I have access to the most reliable sources of information." Despite his denial, Tom thought he detected a shiftiness in his expression. "I was there, damn you, Guy. I saw it with my own eyes." Guy seated himself behind the desk and fiddled with the quill, stroking his own cheek with the plume. "Ah, you actually saw him sold into slavery. How surprising that you did nothing to prevent it." "No, you puffed-up jackanapes," Tom bellowed. "I know that he was in the power of the Muslimman pirates, captured and not dead or drowned. I also know for certain that he was sold into slavery." "What proof do you—" Guy started, but Tom strode to the desk and slammed his hands on the top so that ink spurted up and splattered the piles of documents. "The testimony of the Arabs we captured at Flor de la Mar, and proof of my own eyes and senses. Dorian is alive, I tell you, and it is your duty as a brother and an Englishman to help me find him." Guy leapt to his feet. His face was icy pale, his eyes blazing. "How dare you come here, into my house, into my territory, in your old overweening, blustering style, and dictate to me what I must do?" he screamed at Tom, drops of spittle flying from his lips. "Sweet Christ, Guy, don't tempt me further. I'll whip the hide off your craven back if you don't do your duty by our little brother." "Those days are long past, Thomas Courtney. I am the master here, the chosen representative of His Majesty of the Company. You will find yourself thrown into prison, your fine ship seized and confiscated, if you raise a hand to me." He was shaking with rage. "Don't you dare preach to me, not after what you did to Caroline." His voice rose to a shriek at her name. and Tom recoiled as though struck in the chest by a musket ball. At the same time, Guy stepped back, clearly appalled by what he had allowed to slip past his tongue in anger. Tom was cast into confusion by the accusation, which had struck home. They stared at each other speechlessly, and in the silence a small sound made them both turn to the door that led in from the garden. A woman stood there. She was dressed in a pale green dress of Chinese silk with slashed sleeves and high neck. Her full skirts covered her ankles, and only the toes of her slippers showed. She was staring at Tom, as though at her own ghost. One hand clutched her throat, the other held the hand of the child who toddled beside her. "What are you doing here, Caroline?" Guy roared. "You know well that you may not come here when I have visitors." "I heard voices," Caroline faltered. Her hair was piled high in curls upon her head, and ringlets hung down on her cheeks. But Tom saw that she was sallow of countenance, as though she had recently risen from a sick bed. "I heard my name called out." She was still staring at Tom. The child was in smock and ribbons. His head was covered with blonde curls, and Tom had the impression of an angelic little face and perfect pink lips. "Who's that man?" said the infant, and pointed at Tom with a chuckle. "Take Christopher out of here!" Guy shouted at Caroline. "Immediately!" Caroline seemed not to have heard him. "Tom," she said in a wondering, bemused tone, "I never thought to see you again." Christopher hung on her hand and tried to take an unsteady step towards him, but she pulled him back gently. "How are you, Tom?" "In good health," Tom replied awkwardly, "as I trust you are." "I have been ill," Caroline whispered, staring at him. She moistened her lips. "Since the birth of our—" She paused, blushing and thrown into confusion. "The birth of Christopher." "I am sorry." A shadow of regret passed over Tom's face. "Your family, how are your parents and your sisters?" He had to think of their names. "Agnes and Sarah?" "My father was appointed governor of Bombay. He arranged the post of consul here in Zanzibar for Guy." She glanced nervously at her husband, who was still glaring at her. "My mother died of the cholera a year ago." "I am so sorry," Tom interjected. "She was a delightful lady." "Thank you," Caroline inclined her head sadly. "My sister Agnes married in Bombay." "But she was so young," Tom protested, remembering those two tomboy sisters from the Seraph. "She is no longer a child. She is 17, Caroline corrected him. They were silent again, and Guy sank down into his chair, no longer trying to assert his authority over his wife. Involuntarily, Tom looked down at the child who clung to Caroline's skirts. "He is a beautiful child." He raised his eyes back to her face. She nodded, as though to a question that had not been uttered. "Yes," she said. "He is like his father." Tom had an almost irresistible urge to go to the laughing infant and pick him up. Instead, he stepped back a pace to prevent himself doing so. "Caroline," Guy intervened again, even more forcibly, "I have business to conduct. Please take Christopher away." Caroline seemed to droop, and a desperate look came into her eyes as she studied Tom's face. "It was good to see you again, Tom. Perhaps you will be able to visit us while you are in Zanzibar. Could you come to dine with us here at the consulate one evening?" There was a wistful note in the question. "I do not think Thomas will be here long enough to make social calls." Guy came to his feet again and frowned at her, as if to silence her. "That is a great pity," Caroline said. "Then I will say farewell now." She picked up the little boy. "Goodbye, Tom." "Goodbye, Caroline." Carrying Christopher, she went through the door with a swish of silken skirts. The child looked back solemnly over his mother's shoulder at Tom. For long after they had gone, both brothers were silent. Then Guy said in a controlled, cold voice, "You are to keep away from my family. I will not tolerate you speaking to my wife again. I challenged you to a duel once before. I will again, if you provoke me. It would give me little pleasure to have to kill you. You were never a swordsman, Guy," Tom said, and he thought of William. The guilt was still a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach. "I have no wish to intrude on your private life. From now on, we will touch only on matters of business. Can we agree on that?" "Distasteful as I find any contact with you, I agree," Guy replied. "And the first matter of business is for me to repeat my question. Do you intend to indulge in any form of trade in these waters? I have reports from the harbour that your ship is heavily laden. Do you have a trading license from the company? Do you carry trade goods?" "We are 8,000 miles from London." "We are beyond the line, sir, and I do not recognise your authority in English law to interfere with me or question my intentions." Tom kept his temper under control with an effort. "My first concern is only with Dorian. Have you made inquiry with the Sultan of Zanzibar concerning him?" Guy became agitated. "I have had no reason to approach the Sultan on the subject, and I forbid you to do so. I have managed to establish cordial relations with him. He is now favourably inclined towards England and the company. I do not wish to have that state of affairs disturbed by anyone making accusations against his sovereign lord, Prince Al-Malik." Tom's expression changed abruptly. "How did you know that Al-Malik was the one who bought Dorian as a slave?" "I never mentioned that name." Guy looked confused and was silent for many seconds as he searched for a reply. "Al-Malik is the sovereign overlord of this coast. It was natural for me to assume..." "By God, Guy! It was not natural for you to assume anything. You know something about what has happened to Dorian. If you don't tell me, I will go to the Sultan myself." "You will not!" Guy sprang to his feet. "I will not have you destroying all my work here. You cannot stop me." "Listen to me." Guy changed his tone. "Very well. I will tell you the truth. I also heard these rumours about a white boy with red hair in the hands of the Arabs. Naturally, I thought of Dorian, so I made inquiries of the Sultan. He promised to send a messenger to Prince Al-Malik to find out the truth. I am waiting to hear from the prince." "Why did you lie to me? Why did you not tell me this at once?" Tom demanded. "Why did I have to force it out of you?" "Because I know you well. I did not want you rushing in and antagonizing the Sultan. My dealings with him are very sensitive." "How long ago did you make these inquiries?" Tom demanded. "I want you to keep out of this." Guy sidestepped the question in spite of Tom's insistence. "I have the whole business in my own hands." "How long ago?"
"Some time ago."
Guy looked down at his desk. "Dealings with the Arabs take time." "When?" Tom came to him and thrust his face to Guy's. "When I first arrived here on the island," Guy admitted, "a year ago."
"A year ago?"
Tom shouted.
"A year ago? Well, believe me, I will not wait that long. I will go to the Sultan this very day and demand an answer."
"I forbid it," Guy cried. "I am the consul."
"Forbid all you will, Guy,"
Tom told him grimly. "I am on my way now to the fort." "I will send a full report of your behaviour to Lord Childs in London," Guy threatened desperately. "The company ship in the harbour now will sail within days for England. Lord Childs will bring the full wrath of the company down upon you."
"There is no threat you can make that will stop me searching for Dorian. Send all the reports you wish, Guy, but it will be a year and more before you receive a reply. By then I will be 1,000 miles away with Dorian in my care." "Leave this house at once, sir," Guy shouted, "and don't dare set foot on my threshold again." "That is an invitation very much to my taste, sir."
Tom crammed his hat back onto his head.
"I wish you good morrow."
He strode to the door without looking back, and smiled as Guy yelled after him,
"I forbid you to go near the Sultan's palace. I shall send word to him at once that you are an interloper and do not have the protection of His Majesty, the company, or this office."
Tom strode back along the sandy path towards the harbour, and Aberley had to step out to keep up with him. Aberley had had no reply to his initial questions, so he was silent as he followed Tom. Tom was in a black rage. He wanted to storm into the Sultan's fort above the harbour, take the heathen swine by the throat, and choke the answers out of him. But he was at least able to recognise that his emotions were out of control, that once again he was on the verge of committing some violent act that could bring disaster on his enterprise. I must get back on board the Swallow, where I can do no more harm to myself, and talk to Abberley and Ned before I act, he told himself. But his hand strayed to the hilt of the blue Neptune sword, and his anger flew off on another tack. By God! If to save Dorian I have to take the little Swallow in against the whole Musselman fleet, I will not flinch. There was a shout behind him, so faint that at first it did not penetrate his rage. Then there was the sound of galloping hooves, and the shout came again. Tom! Tom, wait, wait for me! I must talk to you! Tom swung round and glared back down the track. The horse came racing towards him, the rider leaning low on its neck, white sand spurting from under the hoofs. Tom! This time he realized that it was a woman's voice. As the horse came closer, he saw skirts billowing out behind and long hair blowing on the wind. His rage was forgotten in an instant, and he stared at her in astonishment. She was riding astride and bareback, and he saw the flash of pale legs gripping the horse's flanks, naked to well above the knees, where her skirts had rucked up. She lifted one slim arm and waved at him. Tom! Despite her use of his Christian name, he did not recognize her. She brought the bay mare to a plunging halt beside where he stood, and in a rustle of skirts swung down to the ground. She tossed the reins to Abberley. "Hold her, please, Abberley," she said. The big man roused himself from his shock and grabbed the reins. "Tom! Oh, Tom!" The strange girl ran to him and threw her arms around his neck. "I thought I would never see you again!" She hugged him tightly, then stepped back and seized both his hands. "Let me look at you!" She stared into his face, and he stared back. Her long hair was a soft brown, but her face was not beautiful. The jaw too strong, her mouth too wide, especially when she smiled, as she was now. Her eyes were bright English blue, sparkling at him through long lashes. He saw at once that her skin was her main ornament. It was without blemish, but lightly touched by the tropical sun to an unfashionable golden brown. She was almost as tall as he was, her eyes looking straight into his, and she held herself easily and confidently, with a boyish thrust of the hips and set of the shoulders. "You don't recognize me, do you, Tom?" she laughed at him. He shook his head dumbly. He found her face riveting, her eyes full of fun and alive with intelligence. "Forgive me, madam," he faltered. "You have me at a disadvantage." "Madam, indeed," she chided him. "I'm Sarah!" She shook his hand. "Sarah Beatty, Caroline's little sister. You used to call me the gadfly. Why are you always buzzing around my head like a gadfly, Sarah?" she mimicked. "Now do you remember?" "Sweet heavens, how you have changed!" he exclaimed in astonishment, and despite himself looked down at the shapely swell of full breasts under her bodice. "As you have, Tom. What happened to your nose?" He touched the end in embarrassment. "It was broken." "Poor Tom." She made a face of mock sympathy. "But it suits you well enough. Oh, Tom, it's so good to see you." She linked her arm through his and led him down the track towards the town. Abberley fell in behind them at a respectful distance. "I heard your voice when you were shouting at Guy. I could not believe it was yours, although I recognized it immediately." She gave him a roguish sideways glance. "So I listened outside the door. Guy would have beaten me if he had caught me at it." "Does he beat you?" Tom bristled protectively. "We will see to that." "Oh, shush, don't be a booby. I can look after myself. But let's not waste time talking of Guy. I can only stay a moment. They'll miss me and send the servants to look for me." "Sarah, there is so much we have to discuss." Tom felt strangely bereft at the thought of parting from her so soon. Her arm through his was strong and warm. There was a light fragrance around her, like an aura, that stirred something deep inside him. "I know. I heard you talking to Guy about little Dorian. We all love Dorian. I want to help you," she thought quickly. "There's an old ruined Jesuit monastery near the south point of the island. I'll meet you there tomorrow at 2 bells in the afternoon watch." She laughed at him. "You see, I remember all the sailors' things you taught me. Will you be there?" "Of course." She released his arm, turned back to Uberly and embraced him. "Do you remember how we used to play horsey, Uberly? You carried me on your back." A smile lit Uberly's face, transforming it.
"Miss Sarah, you have grown beautiful."
She took the reins from him. "Hand me up." He cupped a huge palm, and when she stepped into it, he boosted her easily onto the mare's back. She flashed a last smile at Tom. "Don't forget," she warned him. She wheeled and slapped her heels into the mare's flanks. Tom watched her gallop away.
"No," he said softly. "I won't forget."
"Effendi, my master the Sultan is indisposed. He is not able to receive any visitors, not even those as important as your exalted self."
The vizier sneered at Tom.
The harbour was filled with the ships of the Franks, all of their captains clamouring for an audience with his master, all seeking favours, licences to trade, permission to visit the forbidden territories further to the north.
"When will he see me?" Tom demanded.
The vizier pursed his mouth with disapproval at such a crass, unsubtle question.
He knew that this young infidel commanded a tiny vessel that could carry little in the way of goods for trade, and he did not have the smell of gold about him. He was hardly worthy of serious attention. Yet he was unusual. He spoke good, intelligible Arabic, and understood the etiquette of business. He had offered suitable gifts to smooth the path to the Sultan.
"That is in the hands of Allah," the vizier shrugged gracefully. "Perhaps a week, perhaps a month, I do not know.
I will be back here tomorrow morning, and every day thereafter, until the Sultan agrees to see me," Tom assured him.
"And I will wait for your return each day, as the drought-struck earth awaits the rains," said the vizier blandly.
Uberly was waiting for him at the gates of the fort, and Tom raised an eyebrow in reply to his unspoken question. He was too angry and frustrated to speak. They retraced their steps through the spice market, where the air was filled with the aroma of cloves and pepper, past the whipping block in the slave market, where some incorrigible woman was chained, with the flesh of her back hanging in bloody festoons, down the street of the gold merchants to the stone quay of the harbour, where the longboat waited. As he took his seat in the stern sheets, Tom glanced up at the sky to judge the angle of the sun, then pulled the silver Tompion watch from his pocket and flipped open the cover. "Row me around to the south point of the island," he ordered. He had checked his chart the previous night and found that the ruins of the old Jesuit monastery were marked upon it. A small cove close by should provide a landing. As the rowers pulled down the channel, close in to the coral reef that showed its teeth through the snoring surf, Tom felt his ill humour evaporate in the gay sunshine at the prospect of his rendezvous with Sarah. Ahead of the longboat, he saw the swells of the open sea beating with more force on the unprotected south point of the island. When he stood up and studied the shore ahead, he could pick out the course of the freshwater stream, marked by lush green vegetation as it ran down into the lagoon. There was always a pass through the reef where the sweet water inhibited the growth of the coral. As they came level with the stream, he made out the deeper water of the pass and steered through it. The beach was deserted, and there was no mark of a keel upon it. Tom jumped from the bows onto the hard white sand without wetting his boots. "I'll be back in an hour or so," he told Uberly. "Wait for me." He found an overgrown path that ran beside the stream and forced his way along it, moving inland until it came out into the open groves of the palm trees. He saw the ruins of the monastery ahead. He increased his pace, and as he came under the tumbled walls, he called out sharply, "Sarah! Are you there?" There was a shriek as a flock of parakeets exploded out of the upper branches of a bow tree whose roots were embedded in the tumbled stone blocks, but no other sound. He continued on around the base of the walls, then heard a horse whinny just ahead of him. He ran forward, unable to restrain himself from showing his eagerness, and found the mare tied in the fallen gateway. Her saddle was stacked at the base of the wall, but there was no sign of her rider. He was about to call again, but thought better of it, and went on cautiously through the gateway. The building was roofless, overgrown with weed and newly germinated palm shoots from fallen coconuts, Blue-headed lizards scurried away among the stones, and butterflies with brilliant wings floated above the tops of the flowers. He stood in the centre of the ancient courtyard and placed his hands on his hips. He remembered her mischievous ways from long ago. It was clear that she had not improved, that she was hiding from him. "I am going to count to 10," he shouted, as he had when she was just a shrimp, "and then I'm coming to get you." Once that threat had been enough to send her and her sister squealing for cover. "One," he counted, and her voice came from high above him. "Guy says that you ravish young virgins." He spun round and saw her perched high on the arch of the gateway, her long legs dangling over the edge, her calves exposed beneath the hem of her skirts, and her feet bare. He had walked right underneath her. "He says that no decent Christian girl is safe when you are on the prowl." She put her head on one side. "Is that true?" "Guy is a fool," Tom grinned up at her. "Guy does not like you very much. No brotherly warmth in his heart." Sarah started to swing her legs, and he stared at them. They were smooth and shapely. "Is Christopher truly yours?" Tom almost reeled at the directness of her question. "Who told you that?" He tried to recover his composure. "Caroline did," she replied. "She hasn't stopped crying since she saw you yesterday." Tom stared up at her, and all she had told him in those few sentences left him in confusion. He could think of nothing to say. "If I come down, will you promise not to pounce on me and give me a baby also?" she asked sweetly, and stood up. He felt a tremor of concern as she balanced easily on top of the rickety wall, and found his voice. "Have a care! You'll fall!" As if she had not heard, she ran along the narrow top of the wall, jumping down from tier to tier until she could hop down the last few feet to the ground. She was as nimble as an acrobat. "I brought a picnic basket for us to share." She walked past him further into the ruins, and he followed her to one of the ancient monk's cells, which, although roofless and open to the sky, was shaded from the slanting sun. She pulled out the basket from where she had hidden it under a pile of palm fronds. She seated herself, twisting up her legs beneath her in that double-jointed feminine attitude that he found so appealing. She arranged her skirts artlessly, giving him another heart-stopping glimpse of those lovely calves. She opened the basket, and as she set out the contents, she asked, "Did you go to see the Sultan?" "He refused me." Tom sat down facing her, leaning his back against one of the blocks and crossing his legs. "Of course! Guy sent word to him to warn him you were coming." She changed the subject with bewildering rapidity. "I helped myself to a bottle of wine from his cellar." She held it up like a trophy. "It's French, and came on the last ship from home." She read the label. "Corton Charlemagne. Is that good?"
"I don't know," Tom admitted,
"but it sounds impressive." "Guy says it's superb. My brother-in-law fancies himself a great connoisseur. He's terribly proud of it. He'd be furious if he knew we were drinking it. I'm allowed only half a glass at supper. Will you open it?" She passed it to Tom and set out platters of pies and cold meat. "I was truly sorry to hear about the death of your father," she said, and her face was sad suddenly. "He was so kind to me and my family on the voyage out to Good Hope."
"Thank you," Tom replied,
as he popped the cork out of the bottle, turning away to hide the shadow that passed across his face. She sensed his sorrow and smiled to cheer him again. "If my own father hadn't arranged the post of consul for Guy, he'd still be a clerk in Bombay. He isn't such a lord high and mighty as he imagines he is." She put on a solemn expression that was so faithful an imitation of his brother that Tom's mood changed, and he grinned as she mimicked Guy's pompous tone and inflection. "I am the youngest consul in the service of His Majesty. I shall have a knighthood before I am 30. Tom guffawed. She was a delight to be with. Then swiftly she changed again and became serious. "Oh, Tom, what are we going to do about poor little Dorian? Guy doesn't really care. All he worries about is the company's trade with the Arabs and Lord Childs in London. He won't do anything to offend the Sultan and the Prince." Tom's expression again became grim. "I will not let Guy or the Omani divert me. I have a fine, fast ship, and if they force me to it, I shall use it.
I know exactly how you are suffering, Tom. I feel as though Dorian is my own brother. I'll do everything I can to help you, but you must be careful.
Guy says that the prince has forbidden any Christian ships to go further north than Zanzibar under penalty of seizure. He says that the Arabs will sell the crews into slavery if they transgress this decree.
She leaned across and placed her hand on his forearm. Her fingers were long and tapered. They felt cool against his skin.
It'll be terribly dangerous. I couldn't bear it if anything happened to you, dear Tom.
I can look after my ship and my crew, he assured her. But her touch was distracting.
I know you can. She withdrew her hand and sparkled at him. Poor Guy's wine.
She set out two pewter cups. Let's see if it's as good as he boasts.
She took a sip.
Hmm, she murmured.
You'd best keep the bottle beside you. Caroline says that ravishers ply their innocent victims with strong drink before having their way with them.
She widened her eyes. And I don't want a child like Caroline, not today at least.
She had a way of keeping him off balance. The blouse she wore had slipped down to expose one shoulder, but she did not seem to have noticed. Agnes has a baby now, too. She married a Captain Hicks in the Company Army at Bombay. It seems both my sisters are brood mares. It may run in the family, so I have to be very careful. You aren't married, are you, Tom?
No. His voice was husky. The skin on her shoulder and arm was smooth and sun-gilded, and there were colourless hairs on her forearms, fine as silk, that caught the sun.
That's good. So what are we going to do about Dorian? Do you want me to spy on Guy and find out everything I can? I don't think he will tell you much himself.
I would be most grateful for your help.
I can go through all his correspondence and eavesdrop on his visitors. There's a hole in the wall where the ropes for the fan go through. It makes a fine confessional.
She looked mightily pleased with herself.
But, of course, we will have to meet here regularly so that I can report to you.
Tom found that prospect far from distasteful.
Do you remember the concerts we used to have in the evenings on board the Seraph? She asked, and burst spontaneously into the chorus of Spanish ladies. Her voice was true and unaffected, and Tom, tone deaf as he was stirred by it. The hair on the back of his neck prickled, and he was sorry when she stopped.
"What happened to Master Walsh, our teacher?" she asked. "He was such a funny little man."
"He is with me on the Swallow."
And he went on to tell her about all the crew she remembered from the Seraph.
She wept when he told her how big Daniel Fisher had died, and he wanted to take her in his arms to comfort her. Instead, he changed the subject and told her about how they had captured the Swallow and about the long voyage out. She listened rapidly, wiped away the tears, and applauded his courage and ingenuity. Soon she was chatting easily again, flitting from subject to subject, as though she had stored up 100 questions for him in the years they had been apart. Tom was intrigued. The longer he studied her face, the more he decided that his first appraisal had been in error. Perhaps her features were not pretty, her nose and mouth were too large, her jaw too square, but put together with the animation and spirit that lit them, he decided she was almost beautiful. Her eyes crinkled when she laughed, and she had a little trick of lifting her chin when she asked a question, which he liked. The shadows moved out across the courtyard as they talked. Suddenly she broke off in the middle of a hilarious description of her family's arrival in Bombay and their reaction to the unfamiliar, exotic new world.
"Oh, Tom, it's late. The time went so quickly. I've stayed too long."
Hastily she gathered up the plates and empty wine cups. "I must go. Guy will be furious if he even suspects where I've been."
"Guy's not your master," Tom frowned.
"He's the master of our household. My father placed me in his care when Mother died. For Caroline's sake, I have to humour him. He takes out his ill temper on her."
"Are you happy living with Guy and Caroline, Sarah?"
He felt that even in the short time they had spent together, he knew her well enough to ask such a delicate question.
"I can think of other circumstances which would please me better," she said, almost inaudibly, without looking up from the picnic basket. Then she pulled on her discarded shoes and jumped to her feet. Tom picked up the basket, and she placed one slim hand on his arm, as if she needed to steady herself over the uneven ground. It was only a short time ago, though,
that he had seen her dancing along the top of the high wall. "When will you come again to give me report of what Guy is doing?" Tom asked, as he lifted the pannier basket onto the mare's back. "Not tomorrow. I promised to help Caroline with Christopher. But the next day, at the same time?" He placed his hands on her waist and lifted her up into the saddle. He hoped she realized the strength that that simple act had required, for she was no delicate lily of a girl. Today she was riding side-saddle. She hooked one leg around the horn, and he helped her arrange her long skirts. Then she looked down at him as he stood by her stirrup. "Oh, Tom," she said impulsively, "it's been such fun. Life on the island is so restricted and boring. Guy won't even let me go into the town on my own. I cannot last remember when I enjoyed myself so much." Then she seemed overcome by embarrassment at her lack of restraint. Without waiting for his response, she urged the mare away and raced off down the sandy path through the palm groves. She sat tall and regal in the saddle.